Ferguson and the Garner case in New York have drawn attention again to the police-related deaths of black men, and in a way we have not seen before. Across the nation, through protests and calls for federal investigations, Americans are questioning police conduct in minority communities, police training, and their use of deadly force. We get a chance to talk about those things this hour with two men who devoted their adult lives to law enforcement, both of them having served as leaders of the 8th largest police force in the country. Former Baltimore Police Commissioners Leonard Hamm and Fred Bielfeld answer my questions and yours about how police are trained, the use of force, and how officers can avoid or de-escalate confrontations with citizens. Our conversation begins after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Thanks again for joining us. Dan Roderick's here. Our phone number, 410-662-8780, if you'd like to join our conversation in this hour. Of course, we've been talking about this a lot lately. Several police-related deaths of unarmed black men and boys have called into question how police decide to use force, either physically or with a weapon. The spotlight lately has been on Ferguson, Missouri, of course, and New York City or Staten Island. But across the country, Americans are asking questions about police conduct, police training, and the use of deadly force. So we thought we'd take this opportunity today to try to get some answers about all of that and some reflection on it. In the studio with me, we're lucky to have two former Baltimore police commissioners, two men who grew up in Baltimore and devoted their adult lives to law enforcement. Frederick Bielfeld, who served as police commissioner from 2007 to 2012, nice to have you back on the show with us, Fred Bielfeld. And Leonard Hamm is here. Leonard Hamm, who served as police commissioner in Baltimore from 2004 to 2007, having come out of retirement to take that position. And during his time, his career in the Baltimore City Police Department, he worked for a time at the police academy and training officers. So it's nice to have you back with us, Leonard Hamm. Leonard Hamm, now a professor of criminal justice at Coppin State University and in charge of the campus police at Coppin State. So let me start with you both. The question, you know, this has been big news the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure you've been following these developments, the grand jury decisions in Ferguson and Staten Island and all the reaction to it. There's been a lot of talk about these two cases. But in general, I just wonder for your reflections on this. What are you thinking today after all of this has passed, what you've heard people say? What are your reflections on it?
Well, first of all, Dan, when the incident first happened, of course, I was shocked and pretty disappointed that it happened, that we have a police officer that has to take deadly force. But I'll tell you the truth, I really wasn't shocked at the grand jury's decision.
In Ferguson?
In Ferguson, I wasn't shocked. Because I kind of know the workings of grand juries, and I kind of knew what a prosecutor would do or should do. And I really wasn't shocked at the reactions of the citizens in terms of the rioting. And what I was shocked about was the reaction of the National Guard and the police. They should have been posted. They should have been deployed better, I think, that first night to calm some of that stuff.
Okay. And what about the Garner case in New York City, a decision there, too, also not to prosecute
To me, inexplicable. I mean, you saw on tape what happened, but again, it's inexplicable, but I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised because you know the way grand juries work and prosecutors?
I know the way prosecutors, grand juries, and I know the way the system works. We as police officers, you know, if in fact we say that I believe my life was in danger and I was afraid, no one can really put themselves in that place and determine what's your level of fear.
Right. As long as there's a reasonable belief that his life was in danger or other lives were in danger. Fred Bielfeld, what about you? What are your reflections on the Ferguson case, the Staten Island case, Mr. Garner, the decisions of those grand juries, and, you know, what you've been hearing from people in the public?
So the thing that struck me about Ferguson right out of the box was the gross insensitivity in that case. I thought from the very beginning at the crime scene management and how they handled the death of that young man on the street at the hands of the government, right? At the hands of the government, the police, that they left his body out there in that median strip for hours. It was like interminable. And it wasn't just that it was a police-involved shooting. It's just common human decency. And the manner in which they handled the initial wave of all of that, in reaction to the protest, they ramped up with all of this militarized reaction with cops on top of armored vehicles pointing assault weapons at the crowd. And to me, it in that first wave, it was that gross insensitivity. And then I had the opportunity to go to Ferguson and actually talk to people on the ground in Ferguson. And if you have a chance to talk to people from the community, what they will tell you is that not only were they estranged from their police department, but their police department was actually doing a lot of very concerted things to mess with them systematically. For example, they would paper up the community, right? And that's a common kind of police adage for issuing a lot of petty citations. And they gave, in this case in Ferguson, they papered them up with a lot of moving violations. And what happened as a result of those moving violations is a number of those people, because they are hardworking, lower middle class folks, lower economic strata, they couldn't afford to take off time from work. So you know what happens? They get FTA'd in court. And now failure to appear. And now there's an open arrest warrant. And there were like something like 20 or 30,000 open arrest warrants for minor offenses in Ferguson. And so you could see, and to me again, Dan, these are kind of the bigger policing issues in the country. You can look at these anecdotal one-off cases and say, well, this is egregious or that's egregious, but there is pretty systematic things going on that need to be addressed. There's a lot of controversy around the stop and frisk in New York. And the fact of the matter is that might have had its place at a high crime time when people are carrying a lot of weapons on the street and there's a high violent crime rate. That might generate a lot of probable cause to search people for weapons because, in fact, they are carrying weapons. But when crime is at historic lows and people aren't carrying weapons, how do you justify the constitutional protection of people's Fourth Amendment rights to do these searches?
So, Leonard Hamm, what I hear Fred describing is a atmosphere of tension, heightened tension, where citizens feel harassed because of the overall approach the police are taking in a specific community.
Absolutely, and this is happening right now in many communities in America right now. And one of the things I teach my class is that you go into a community and you study that community and you can almost predict when something is going to boil over. And historically, we've had situations where people in communities have felt disenfranchised, a hopelessness, government not addressing their needs. And then there's this spark. It's always a police officer stopping somebody or doing something, and the place glows up in flames. We've seen it happen in Watts. We've seen it with Rodney King. We've seen it many times before. It's this underswelling of people not being satisfied in their life.
Mm-hmm. And also feeling harassed.
That's right.
Okay, I want to ask you about the Ferguson case, and I'm just going to throw this question out there. The Ferguson case and the Staten Island case, you step back from it a bit, and you reflect on it and say, okay, what happened here? The police officer in Ferguson had to stop a young man or two young men on the street because he had received some message that a convenience store nearby had been robbed. There had been a robbery. So he stops this young man on the street, asks him to stop. And it looks like there's a problem, right? Because it gets tense, it gets physical, the shots are fired because the officer says he told the grand jury he thought the Michael Brown was reaching for his gun, right? But then he followed him, right? And the death of Michael Brown occurred around the corner on another street. So my question was, why don't you just back off and wait for a minute. Wait for help. Call yeah. for backup. Call see, for support.
See, but
instead of going one on one with a young man on the street.
Yes. Yeah, so
okay, this is my unprofessional question
yes,
to you. So
look,
what are you supposed to do?
You know, in terms of breaking that case down, right? And so I know maybe less than you know in following the whole thing. I haven't read the grand jury report, but I followed some of the basic elements. And first of all, I don't believe that Darren Wilson, that's the officer in Ferguson, right. I don't believe that Darren Wilson knew that Michael Brown was indeed the suspect from this theft or robbery, the robbery of the convenience store or the cigars. I don't believe that Darren Wilson knew that, and I don't think he testifies to that. What he says essentially is he's responding as backup, right? So, but his
encounter— Because the store has been robbed.
Yeah, because right. the store, and he's on his way there, and as he's on the way, Michael Brown is in the street, actually in the street, and their initial engagement, their initial encounter is for the officer to yell at Brown to essentially get out of the street. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine, based on the relationship in the neighborhood, that that wasn't some courteous exchange. It was probably, I'm the police, you get the heck out of the street or whatever, which Brown takes exception to, and for whatever constitutes Brown's mentality, they get into this fight.
It's an altercation.
An altercation with Wilson still in the car. Now, this is the important part, and this is where I see it in two parts. I think that Darren Wilson's initial approach to Brown was probably way off base, and it could have been handled differently. But when Brown and Wilson are fighting for that weapon inside the car and they're in this physical altercation, that's where, from a policing standpoint, you just can't expect, based on the training that most cops receive in this country, that Wilson would disengage from that assault. Now he's been physically assaulted,
a felony. He's fired his weapon twice. Right?
He's fired it while he's inside the car. And right. And listen, Brown's DNA is on the gun. That's irrefutable. And so he didn't go over and pick his hand up on the crime scene and smear it on his weapon.
No,
there
I'm with
was
you on
a
that.
Fight in the
is,
car.
Is the training then to pursue
but
him?
But the training, listen, let me give you a sports analogy. You taught kids how to play sports, right? Mm. Let me give you soccer, right? When you teach kids to play soccer, which direction do they kick the ball? All of them.
I don't know. Forward?
Forward, forward to the opposing goal
right.
always.
Right.
It takes years of training, years of practice to teach kids that it's okay to kick the ball backwards, to reset the play. And this is the same mentality in policing, Dan, in that the police get moving forward and they don't go from 1 to 10, down to 7 to 4. They go from 1 to 10 and follow that progression.
But is that advisable? That's my
no,
question.
No, it's not advisable.
That's not
you
the training.
Want to teach
no.
them.
So
you
what
want
would,
to teach them to
let's
come
hear
back
from Leonard
down.
On that.
What
so
has
what,
to happen
in that
is,
scenario, what should
have what has to happen is we have to teach officers, and what we try to teach officers is critical thinking in intense situations and stressful situations. That's what we try to do. Now, at some point, what I saw some diagrams of that, there was maybe 15, 20 feet separating the two. The young man's back was turned. His hands was up. He was running or whatever the case may be. Common sense would say in a situation like that, hey, I know who the guy is. Let him go. I'll get a warrant, come back later on, get a warrant and lock him up, you know.
Well, that's sort of the thought that occurred to me.
Common sense would say that.
That would diffuse
the tension. I'm not there. I don't know how heightened it is and all that. But I've been in situations on the streets of Baltimore where I've taken that, you know, that way out. Hey, go ahead, Leroy, go at home. I know where you live. I'll come back and I'll get you tomorrow.
Fred, does that sound reasonable?
I think, you know, again, we're Commissioner Hamm and I are seasoned veteran law right. enforcement people. We have 70 years of law enforcement between the two of us easily. And so it's easy as a 52-year-old seasoned veteran
right.
to say, ah, run, I'll catch you another day. When you're 25 years old, when you're 30 years old and you're confronted, these officers feel and embody, they are the line of defense between evil in society and good in society. And so most of these men and women who hazard their lives every day to protect us, which we shouldn't take for granted, that when they're exposed to these dangerous situations, they feel compelled to move forward in that and ameliorate the situation immediately.
But what's the training? What's the instruction?
Right. This is the difficulty with training in policing in America, and this is about to be the compounding of a difficult problem. The compounding, Dan, is this. Now people are going to come in waves with these quick fix solutions to this, and what he knows and I know is there isn't a quick fix.
Right.
This is really in-depth stuff that you have to work on.
We'll take a little break here and hear more about that. That's Fred Bielfeld, former Baltimore Police Commissioner, along with Leonard Hamm, former Baltimore Police Commissioner, both in our studio for this hour. If you have a comment or question for either gentleman, please give me a ring at 410-662-8780. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here with Leonard Hamm, who served as Baltimore Police Commissioner, and Fred Bielfeld, who succeeded him as Baltimore Police Commissioner. Get a chance to speak to both of these gentlemen about Ferguson, about the Staten Island case, Mr. Garner, police training, and the use of deadly force. And we left off with Fred saying how he expected to be hearing a lot of recommendations now about what should be done in terms of training, in terms of police conduct on the street. Is that what you're expecting?
We lived through this as well, right? In terms of race relations and tension in community, there was a wave of training through the late 90s where people were huckstering cultural diversity training. And I thought it was like preposterous that you could have officers come in for a 1 hour speech by some salesperson that's going to make them more culturally diverse. It was preposterous.
Culturally sensitive.
Right. And it was just ludicrous. And that's about to happen in this country again, because there's going to be a whole bunch of people who run around huckstering this training, and a whole bunch of police chiefs across America that for publicity stunts are going to subscribe to this stuff and go before their local government and saying, this is what we're doing to make our department.
And you think it's superficial?
Incredibly superficial.
Leonard, do you agree with that, Leonard?
And the government's reaction is to throw money at it, and that's going to cure it, and it's not going to cure that.
What's going to cure it?
I have some ideas. I'll share them with you.
Please do.
First of all, I think we have to take a look at recruiting and how we're recruiting. And I've said this time and time again. You know, when most police agencies want to recruit, their mailing material always showed a squad on front and a helicopter and the armored vehicle stuff.
Yeah, the excitement of being a police officer.
So we're recruiting people and say, this is an adventure. Come here and join in this adventure, when we need to look for people who want to serve in the spirit of service.
Yeah,
we got to find those kind of people.
I'm interested in this idea of in the training of police officers, the idea that they're there to help the community. Every community is different. You have to cater how you behave, how you conduct yourself, how you police to the community you're serving.
All policing is local, you know, and what Fred and I found out was, even in Baltimore City, the strategies that we put in place for the west side of town weren't going to necessarily work on the east side
of
town.
Right. Yeah.
So we had to structure training and strategies based on that individual community that we had out there. Another thing I'd like to see happen, and I saw this being in the police academy, training in the police academy, running police academy, is these academies are isolated. And then what happens is that we train and we talk about community and we talk about service, but there's an underlining theme that runs through that academy that's not said, not spoken. It's us against them. That's what happens when you isolate that academy. And I've actually seen trainees who were loving, decent people in that 14, 15 week, they've turned into something different. Something completely different.
That you wouldn't hear on the radio.
I'd like to see police academies put on college campuses so that they can interchange with college students, rub elbows with college students, because Fred and I have found out that the way people get to know one another is to engage each other.
Yeah. On the ground.
On the ground.
So you don't like the idea of a physical police academy away someplace in an isolated place.
No, I don't.
Right? Interesting. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Steve in Forest Hill will take your call, your comments. Welcome to Midday. Stephen, are you there? Okay, we lost Stephen. I'm going to read an email that came in from a retired Maryland State Police officer, trooper. There are four outcomes possible in isolated police-civilian encounters. One, everything is fine. Two, a perpetrator is detained. Three, the police officer is hurt or killed. Or four, the civilian is hurt or killed. Every police officer wants to go home after the shift is over. Please, everyone, put the police officer at ease by showing your hands. And if in a car at night, put on the dome light and keep your hands on the wheel until the officer requests you do otherwise. This is just a cautionary email sent to us by a police officer, because I agree with you. Police officers want to go home at the end of every shift. I want to ask the question about deadly force, use of deadly force, and how is that subject even introduced to cadets in the academy? How is it taught? And are they taught about the law, the Supreme Court rulings on, this reasonable belief of being in danger, and that are police officers taught that they're given wide latitude in the use of deadly force?
We teach the law first, specifically the Supreme Court case of Garner versus Tennessee.
Garner versus Tennessee.
We right. teach that. For those who don't know, it basically, if in fact a felon is running away from a scene of a crime and there's no danger to that police officer or to anybody else, police officers do not have the authority to shoot that person who's running away. All right?
All right.
So there's no wide latitude. And then we have what we call the force continuum, you know, that you know, depending on situations, you have to escalate your use of force, and as a force.
Leonard Hamm, I use the word, I'm still calling you commissioner, I'll call you commissioner mm-hmm. too. I use the word the words wide latitude, because when you look at the record of investigations of police officers for use of excessive force or use of deadly force, you don't see many indictments, and you certainly don't see many prosecutions over the years. So this Supreme Court ruling has been interpreted to say that if you have a reasonable belief that your life is in danger, you can use deadly force.
But this isn't new. This really isn't new. And you're a Baltimorean
guy. I'm not saying it is new.
You're a Baltimorean guy, and the commissioner is from Baltimore. There was a famous case in Baltimore, a detective that set off all kinds of protests in the late 70s. This detective shot this kid who had a cigarette lighter.
I remember that case.
Right?
It was the early 80s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it set off a wave of protest and controversy in Baltimore around police force and police shootings mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. And that officer wasn't indicted in that case. And
because he had a reasonable belief that
his life was in danger, right? And you're making these kinds of split-second decisions. The unfortunate consequence in some of this and the backlash may, frankly, hazard police officers moving forward in this country. There was just a case that was in the Police Executive Research Forum's news postings from yesterday. Some officers in Milwaukee are being lauded for not using force, and a man that was armed with a butcher knife and chased them around a crime scene, a man who had just committed a murder, and this guy was armed with a butcher knife, and he was chasing the officers around, and they didn't use force in that case. And they're being, you know, the byline on it is, you know, how great a level of restraint that they showed. My concern, Dan, is that officers may hazard themselves in these dangerous situations, and now this really public backlash against use of force could have unintended consequences and make officers more unsafe. And the way to get through this as a country, as a community, is for people to work together to understand what police can and can't do. That people have this very misconstrued Star Wars, Star Trek mentality about what weaponry police possess, what skills they possess, just on shooting. Let me give you that one. The people believe all the time, and they come up to you all the time and say, why didn't they shoot the gun out of his hand?
That's right.
Why didn't they shoot him in the leg?
That's why I have you both here today, because that question came up on the air.
So let me tell you why. So you give police basic firearms training. They're not ninja. They're people from the community, and you put them on a range with a weapon they never even held a pistol in their lives, and they shoot a few hundred rounds, and we call them qualified. And then once a year, they come in and shoot 100 rounds at a range under sterile conditions, and even if you try to subject them to stress, they still are going to hit the paper target, and it's just paper, right? Now they're out on the street, and they wind up in a deadly force situation, and we're taught, here's what we're taught. You shoot to incapacitate the threat. Once you draw your weapon, you're shooting to incapacitate the threat. So that doesn't mean you're shooting to kill. It means you're trying to make them stop. And I've had people come up to me and say, I really want to thank you. That man that was armed with the gun, your guy shot him in the arm, and they did such a marvelous job. They didn't take his life. And I always would thank them and say thank you. But you know what I knew? We missed.
Missed.
Because the part of the target.
We never teach anyone to shoot at the center mass, the torso. They missed.
Neck to the waist.
They missed. Yeah. And more often than not, cops miss. Right. In these shootings, they miss what their target is. You know, in the Brown case, Wilson talks about at the last second he saw the top of Michael Brown's head and fired that round. And it was ultimately the round that killed the young man. Mm-hmm. And so this whole notion that cops are ninjas and cops are SEAL team members, it's all hooey. That's not what cops are.
We need to take a break. When we get back, we'll hear more from Fred Bielfeld and Leonard Hamm, police commissioners of Baltimore, former police commissioners of Baltimore. And we'll take some calls with questions. 410-662-8780. Our conversation continues in just a moment. I was just looking at the Washington Post description of the Tennessee versus Garner Supreme Court ruling that Leonard Hamm mentioned a little while ago, 1985 case. The court concluded that police officers could not shoot at a fleeing suspect simply to prevent their escape, as you stated. Mm-hmm. They could shoot, however, if they had probable cause to believe the person was a violent felon and posed a significant threat of death or serious harm to the community. You know, the case I wrote about in my Sun column last week, the officer Tommy Sanders, who shot a fleeing suspect in 2008, mm-hmm. he was mm-hmm. actually indicted,
yes,
stood trial, yes, testified in court that he thought the suspect was
going for a weapon,
going for raising his hand as if mm-hmm. to reach into mm-hmm. a pocket or something and pulled mm-hmm. something, and a jury acquitted him. Mm-hmm. And you know, juries did not indict Officer Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, and the officer in Staten Island. And I don't know what happens there. Some people say, well, that's prosecutorial manipulation. Prosecutors can get people to indict a ham sandwich if they wish or not, right?
Yeah. Yep.
It may also be that citizens give a police officer the benefit of the doubt. That push come to shove, if you're actually on a grand jury or even a trial jury, that you're inclined to believe a police officer. I don't know. What do you want to? I know it's speculation, but I mean, what do you think happens there with people?
I think that, first of all, they're given much more facts and much more information than we have as a consumer on the outside of the incident. And the people who are really analyzing it down to the split second, they get in those moments with those police officers and they have to ask themselves, so what do I expect as a society? Do we expect that you get to take the first shot at the cop before the officer can respond? Is that the standard we want to get to as a society? And already the use of force requirements for most police officers hazard the police. Let me give you a classic example. There was a photograph of Police Commissioner Bill Bratton in New York in the first night of the protest after the Garner decision. Did you see the photograph?
No.
Someone had thrown blood or fake blood or something on Bratton.
Right.
And it's a picture of the commissioner walking into some space after they had thrown this substance on him.
I read about it, yeah.
Right? Okay. Now, here they are trying to defuse these situations, and someone was able to get close enough to actually throw that on them. What if it had been acid or lye? The outcome could have been tragic, right? And so even in these cases, what we're telling police all across America right now as we speak, to be use restraint. And even in telling them to use restraint, the commissioner in New York hazarded himself in such a way, Dan, that I would say to you, probably would not have under other circumstances.
Leonard Hamm, a question for you. Given the reaction that people have to these grand jury decisions and the role of the local prosecutor in there, it's been suggested by me and others, other people have suggested this too, that in the case of a police officer killing a civilian under whatever circumstances, if you're going to have an investigation, a grand jury investigation, bring an independent prosecutor in. Don't have the local district attorney or state's attorney handle it. What do you think of that?
I agree that some way, somehow, we should have a separate set of prosecutors, you know, to try police officers if that's the case, maybe for a couple of reasons. I think that makes the process much more open. You know, and let the facts come out and let them, you know, go where they go. But I'm in favor of that because there is the perception that the prosecutors in Baltimore City and the police are in cohesion, that they're partners, that they go to the FOP to drink together, you know, and they kind of get together and figure out what they're going to do and with these cases. So maybe a separate set of prosecutors would alleviate at least that.
But, I think, Dan, this is a situation that communities in New York and Baltimore have been trying to address for years. And we shouldn't just focus on the big cases of the shootings and that sort of thing. There are a lot of discourtesy, use of force situations where the community's calling for greater involvement and greater ability to engage the process of disciplining police officers. And one of the outcomes really of this, of all of this in America, could be a greater partnership where police unions can agree with the communities to give greater latitude and greater engagement on how officers are disciplined and how the community reviews these cases. Because up to this point in America, those citizen review boards have been paper tigers.
Or in Baltimore, you're right, Alvin Gilliard's group could be given many more resources, given subpoena power, given money for investigators, their own investigators, and really give that community relations commission here in Baltimore City some real power to do its job.
Gilliard's group is the Human Relations Commission.
Human Relations Commission, right.
Stephen is back. He called back, so we'll take his call. I hope he's still there this time. And Forrest Hill, go ahead, Stephen.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Right here.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I have a point to make, which has to do with training. I thought it was well explained that short-term solutions don't work, but it requires considerable training and resources. And what I find is that governments and municipalities, they do not put the money into the training for long-term purposes. They're always worried about their budgets and how they want to cut things, and money for training is considered fraud and abuse for a lot of managers.
Let me ask Leonard Hamm, you were at the academy for a while.
Yes.
I don't know, but the current information would be, how much training does a police officer get before he goes on the street and then after that?
We normally gave 16 weeks. 16 weeks equated to maybe 5 months or so. Then there was a three-month period where officers went to field training officers and trained an additional 3 months.
But and then is there any more training that, in follow-up to that?
There is. There's in-service training, which has been in most police departments, it's been a joke and the inside joke of policing for decades, the notion of in-service training. But let me say
Excuse
for
me.
A second.
Why is that a joke? I don't know enough to
like what you get is state mandates. And so most states have a police training commission that adopts the 40 hours of training that the police department has to administer each year. And they'll come up with some topic like domestic violence training, bloodborne pathogens, CPR recertifications. And they'll lump all that in there.
What is that?
The flavor of the day.
So you're saying some of that. Well, what kind of training would you have for officers then?
You know what you could do? You could do team training, right? And this is one of the things that we were big advocates for, is stop sending officers from all over the department to train as individuals. Train them as teams. Work as teams. Because the guys and gals that are on the street, the people that were surrounding Garner and trying to restrain him, they were a team of people that should have trained together. Let me say this also about training. The caller is absolutely right, because most local governments lack the resources, and police departments have to beg, borrow, and hustle to get money for training. And one of the things we raised money for was tasers.
Right.
And there was such a big advocacy around less lethal, but governments can't afford that equipment, so you have to get it from the private sector.
And what happens is when there's a shortfall, and we know in the police department that we have to cut, we normally cut academy classes. You can't cut and take people off the street, but you cut those guys that are in the academy, or you cut your academy classes back. So you're right. The academies are the first ones to be hit when you have a shortage.
Emmanuel in Pikesville, go right ahead. We're short of time, so please try to be brief.
Okay. I just wanted to say about the Michael Brown thing, all those bullets, okay? I think that's really why people were outraged. I mean, to apprehend a suspect is one thing you try to do, but everybody thinks the guy, pretty much slaughtered him. And for the guy in New York, I mean, they put the video on TV. The guy's asking for relief. He doesn't get it. And then they take it to a grand jury. It's like the grand jury never even listened to it. And I think that's what got the outrage.
You're right about that, Emmanuel, and Leonard Hammond, Fred Bielfeld. I mean, that's the videotape all of America, all the world has seen now.
Yeah, sure.
And it's inexplicable that could be acceptable in some way, not at least involuntary manslaughter or voluntary manslaughter or something.
Listen, there's a ton of police video out there. That made national news, but I will tell you, and I know the commissioner, he pulls together lesson plans, and when I was at Stevenson pulling together lesson plans, there is no shortage of video of crazy police actions. It used to be car cams. Now that police are wearing body cams, and the stuff you see is like crazy. But what it really comes down to is a foundational piece, Dan. It's not going to be about wiring cops with cameras.
That's right.
It's going to be about training
from the beginning,
and real training and sustained training
from the beginning.
So I hear you say maybe body cameras are okay, but you need more training.
You need more.
Absolutely,
that's right.
So you would support body cameras?
Yes.
Leonard Hamm, you do? And
yes.
Fred Bielfeld?
Yeah, I think it's an essential element moving forward.
But more training.
It's a piece, absolutely.
Well, listen, thank you very much for being here today, both of you. It's nice to see you both again. Leonard Hamm, who served as a Baltimore police commissioner, and Fred Bielfeld, who succeeded him as police commissioner. Leonard Hamm, a professor of criminal justice at Coppin State University and in charge of the police department
at
Coppin State. Mm-hmm. And Fred Bielfeld now has moved on to a job in global security with Under Armour. So nice to have you both on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in.